This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Disaster on a California highway. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Bruce Vail, who's in for Jennifer Koschenka. On this Monday, October 24, thanks for being with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
A bus returning from a casino trip slammed into the back of a semi, killing 13 people and injuring 31 others near Palm Springs. Investigators are trying to determine how it happened.
The ink is barely dry on the proposal, and already there's resistance to AT&T's offer to buy Time Warner for some $80 billion.
The Obama administration is trying yet another social media campaign to reach would-be terrorists overseas. Details in about 2 minutes.
And why schedule flexibility may be an overrated perk on the job.
That makes it so hard to deal with childcare, to deal with caring for an aging parent, something like that, where you really need regular hours. And I think it's about 1 in 4, I mean, quite high number of people who have these sort of irregular kind of shift jobs.
Market Watch reporter Katie Hill on why workers prefer stability to flexibility. She's here in about 20 minutes. 13 people have been killed and 31 injured when a charter bus returning to Los Angeles from a casino trip slammed into the back of a semi-trailer truck on a highway near Palm Springs, California. It happened early yesterday morning as the bus, operated by USA Holiday Bus, was headed home to L.A. from a trip to Red Earth Casino, about 160 miles southeast of Los Angeles. Most of the 44 passengers were sleeping as the bus made impact. Henry Tercios was one of the survivors.
I flew off. I hit it. I hit all the seats. And I got my jaw out of place. My face, all this broken nose.
Investigators say it wasn't clear whether the driver was speeding, but officials believe that the truck was only going about 5 miles an hour when it was rear-ended. The bus driver was one of the people killed. The driver of the truck also sustained injuries. The bus hit the truck with enough speed that the semi-trailer ended up about 15 feet into the bus. AT&T wants to buy Time Warner for about $85 billion, but regulators will get their say. And right now, there's opposition from some lawmakers as well as media and telecom rivals. Even before the deal was announced over the weekend, members of Congress, industry groups, and Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump began to question it, expressing concern about higher costs and fewer choices. Here's Columbia University law professor Eric Talley.
AT&T was very much trying to create much more of a footprint in the media content delivery business, and Time Warner itself was much more involved in recent years in various types of content delivery activities.
AT&T Chief Executive Randall Stephenson, meanwhile, played down the objections, arguing the combination of a content provider and a distributor did not increase industry concentration. Regulators will likely focus on whether AT&T would favor content acquired from Time Warner, if the merger would lead to higher prices, or if it would actually widen the playing field by making AT&T a stronger competitor. The Obama administration, which has struggled for years to combat the social media lure of Islamic State, is once again experimenting with new ways to put its online anti-extremism message in front of would-be terrorist fighters overseas. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Felicia Schwartz. Felicia, what are you hearing?
First and foremost, the U.S. is just not a credible messenger for the people that would be interested in going over the border and joining Islamic State. So basically, one of their big challenges is trying to figure out how can they promote these efforts without having their fingerprints all over them. And another challenge, too, is you can never an ad campaign at a pizza shop. You run an ad campaign. Last month, you sold 10 pizzas. This month, you sell 100. There's no way to really know how effective this kind of effort is because you can't find individual people for the most part and figure out, oh, they watched one ad or they were engaged with U.S. efforts in one way or the or the other, and now they've decided not to go. So there's a measurement challenge, too.
So who's the target of these messages?
In this specific campaign, what the Global Engagement Center did is they basically bought, the way any other business on Facebook would, they said, we want to reach a certain population. In this case, it was unmarried men and women ages 13 to 34 in Morocco, Tunisia, and Saudi Arabia, and who had, you know, based on their Facebook, what everyone can see publicly, had indicated that they were interested in Iraq or Syria or some sort of ISIS-related Facebook page.
So the general message here is don't join ISIS. It's a losing cause. Don't believe their stuff. But how is the U.S. trying to communicate that in different words?
So what they have found over, I guess, the past few years of trial and error is that content with defectors works really well. This effort was part of a sort of broader global campaign using defector content. So basically, the one video that I describe in the story, which I was able to watch but unfortunately not share because of security concerns, was a cartoon. Cartoons do well in the Arab world, basically, with a young man kind of texting with an ISIS recruiter, you know, asking a lot of questions about the group and what it would be like. And, the recruiter encourages the man to trust them, and then he sort of goes, joins the group, sees that it's not what he thought it would be, and that it was really, really hard to leave. So they found that those kinds of messages are pretty successful, not in part showing that ISIS is a bad group, but also the sort of like personal cost to going or, you know, it not meeting your expectations.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal national security reporter Felicia Schwartz. Her piece is called U.S. Targets Would-Be Terrorists Overseas with new ad campaign. All right, so you write about this Global Engagement Center, which is based at the State Department. Has the U.S. ever thought of going to an outside agency where there might be like a different perspective on a way to reach these folks?
Sure. Well, there's a few. I mean, one, this is just one. Basically, this story is about like one new effort where they have, you know, data that they can kind of share for the first time. One of the issues about covering these efforts is that they often can't really share what they're doing. So the spotlight is on this particular effort because they have data, but the State Department supports similar work by Facebook on their own. Google Jigsaw does a similar program with some State Department, input and maybe some grant funding. The State Department works with, they do a lot of grant funding to sort of empower grassroots organizations to do this kind of messaging as well. So this is one specific effort in a much broader network of efforts delivering these kinds of messages.
Thanks, Felicia. Wall Street Journal reporter Felicia Schwartz. 14 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Coming up next, war veterans told to return a re-enlistment bonus. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. The Pentagon wants thousands of California Army National Guard soldiers to give back bonuses they were given to re-enlist in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Los Angeles Times says nearly 10,000 soldiers have been ordered to repay the cash bonuses after audits revealed widespread overpayments by California Guard officials under pressure to meet enlistment targets at the height of the wars 10 years ago. Major General Matthew Beavers is deputy commander of the California Guard.
It was absolutely a flaw in the system. Internal controls weren't appropriate enough at the time, and it created a significant fraud.
The Army asked wounded Iraq veteran and former Army Captain Christopher Van Meter, who's 42, to repay a $25,000 reenlistment bonus. The Times also reported that 48-year-old Sergeant Robert Richmond, who suffered permanent injuries in a roadside bomb attack, is refusing to repay his $15,000 that he got 10 years ago. The Army says he was ineligible because he had already served 20 years in the Army. It's 20 minutes now after the hour on This Morning. Bruce Vail is here with more of America's First News.
Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton is already looking beyond the November election. She told reporters in North Carolina that she wants to spend less time talking about Donald Trump and more time working to bolster Democratic numbers in Congress. Her advisors also are trying to figure out ways to curb the bitterness brought on by the election. But Mrs. Clinton says it really shouldn't be a surprise that there's animosity among the parties.
They didn't all get along with each other. They were not all best friends. Our founders had real differences, big difference between Hamilton and Jefferson.
Hamilton, I believe, also had a few issues with Aaron Burr, and we all know how that turned out. Several lawmakers and politicians already are voicing their opposition to AT&T's planned $85 billion acquisition of Time Warner. Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine says he has some questions.
Generally pro-competition and less concentration, I think, is generally helpful, especially in the media. But this has just been announced, and I haven't had a chance to dig into the details.
Tropical storm Seymour is gaining strength in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Mexico and is expected to become a hurricane. The storm's maximum sustained winds have increased to near 65 miles per hour, and Seymour is expected to gain hurricane status later in the day, although right now it is not a threat to land. Famed 1960s anti-war activist Tom Hayden has passed away at age 76 following a long illness. In 1968, Mr. Hayden helped organize the anti-war demonstrations during the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. He later won election to the California Assembly and Senate, where he served for nearly two decades. He was also married to actress Jane Fonda for 17 years. And did you stay up late last night to watch the NFL game between the Seattle Seahawks and the Arizona Cardinals? You probably didn't like the result as the two teams battled to a 6-6 tie after overtime. That's rare in the NFL. Both teams missed easy field goals in overtime, and it was the league's first tie in more than 2 years.
6 points.
For each team.
Ryan Fitzpatrick can throw that many interceptions in a single game.
Just takes one play.
I mean, come on here with the 6 points. Thank you, Bruce. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Time now for a small business update, and it's brought to you by Dell. Check out Dell's new XPS 13 laptop featuring incredible battery life and performance that's four times faster. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. Is flexible scheduling an overrated perk? Katie Hill at MarketWatch says a new survey finds workers would prefer the stability of a 9-to-5 rather than taking a pay cut to work the hours they want. Katie, what's up here?
This is a big study coming out of Princeton and Harvard. They looked at 7,000 people applying for jobs, and they found that most people say that they want to work Monday through Friday, 9-to-5. And I bet everybody's groaning right now hearing that. But yeah, when they offered a bunch of options for these workers in this study. One of them was flexible scheduling. You know, you could either choose to work Monday through Friday, 9-to-5, or you could work the same number of hours a week, but you could make your own schedule. And most of the workers said they would not take a pay cut, nothing at all, no pay cut, to be able to make their own hours. And so looking at this, it's like people just think, okay, Monday 9-to-5, not that bad. What they really hate is having to work, you know, nights and weekends for no extra pay. They really despise that. And even for extra pay, they said in the survey, they would not work nights and weekends. People just want that 40-hour work week. And I get it, you know, because it's for a lot of people, I started digging into this, you know, daycares are open, right? They're open Monday through Friday, you know, 8-to-6. And your schools for your kids, the same thing. There's just certain hours for these. And so for a lot of people, it causes family, you know, work conflict when they do not have sort of set hours like that.
Are we willing to sacrifice in order to get that flexibility or stability?
No, I mean, no, we're not willing to sacrifice to get that flexibility. Really, what they said is we would not take any cut in our pay to be able to set our own schedules.
Wow.
Which it surprised me because I thought, well, I would,
yeah, sure.
But that's just for me personally. But most people said no. I mean, they would, you know, they just wouldn't sacrifice any part of their salary to be able to get that flexibility. What they would be willing to take a pay cut to avoid is those nights and weekends. So, you know, having to work, you know, after whatever 6 p.m., 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. Having to work on weekends. People said they would definitely take a pay cut to do that.
Well, we're speaking with MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill. Her piece is called Stop Whining About Your 9-to-5. Workers want stability more than flexibility. What about working from home? I guess we always got to bring that up in this day and age.
Yeah, this is actually something that people would take a pay cut for. An 8% pay cut, they said, to get to work from home. Because that's because, you know, let's say you're working Monday through Friday, 9-to-5, but you have a family emergency. You're right by, you know, say you could go quickly pick your kid up from school right near your house, you know. Whereas if you're in the office, that's a 2-hour, you know, back and forth situation, and you can't really do it. So I think working from home, people feel like that would give them a slight amount of more flexibility. They could pop out and do an errand in the middle of the day, or they can, you know, grab the kids or whatever. But, and so that would create a lot less, you know, work family conflict there. But yeah, you know, I mean, the reality of the situation is there are so many people on a regular shift, you know, everyone from a doctor who might be on call to a lot of people just have jobs where it's like their employer just says, okay, this week it's this hours and this week it's this hours, and you can never really predict it. And that makes it so hard to deal with childcare, to deal with caring for an aging parent, something like that, where you really need regular hours. And I think it's about one in four. I mean, it's a quite high number of people who have these sort of irregular kind of shift jobs.
Thanks, Katie. MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill in New York. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us on this Monday, October 24. Gordon Deal with Bruce Vail, who's filling in for Jennifer Kashenka. Some of our top stories and headlines: 13 people killed, 31 injured in a bus wreck in California. Resistance to AT&T's proposal to buy Time Warner. Front page story in the Wall Street Journal says Clinton ally and Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe gave $500,000 to the election campaign of the wife of an FBI official who was involved in the probe of Hillary's email use. Monday Night Football, Houston at Denver. They'll try to combine for more than 12 points like the Seahawks and Cardinals last night. And the yoga pants protest in Rhode Island. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, the 2016 presidential race is forcing the television industry to zig and zag its way through the final weeks. Even books and movies are being forced to try new strategies to reclaim their fans, who are paying more attention than usual to politics, apparently. Here's Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen. John, what are we seeing?
We're seeing the kind of behavior that often gets applied to Netflix and other kinds of entertainment, you know, when you just can't really turn away from something, you know, a narrative that's really caught your obsession. And in this case, it's the election, you know, with so much craziness and drama happening in the presidential race on a daily and even sometimes hourly basis. A lot of people just can't turn away from it, and, you know, for better or worse. So part of it is that kind of addiction to the election that we were looking at, but also the ripple effects from that, you know, how that's affecting the way people are doing things they normally do in the fall, like reading books and watching new fall TV shows and going to the movies. And from what we've been finding, it looks like that's been kind of impacting that a little bit. People are doing that stuff less because they're just completely consumed by election stuff.
Wow. I mean, as you point out, even the mighty NFL has noticed a dip in viewers, right?
Yeah. You know, it's the NFL, and this is all, you know, to be said, is that, you know, obviously there's a lot of other stuff going on. There's other factors that the NFL and the TV networks and the, you know, the Hollywood studios are dealing with, you know, as people get distracted from their products. But the NFL has blamed, you know, they've tried to scapegoat the election a little bit, you know, especially when they're going up against debates, they're going to feel a little bit of that loss in viewers. You know, they have other issues going on. You know, they had a lack of stars, a lot of, you know, star athletes in the lineup this year. You know, people are finding it less exciting to watch. So there are things going on that are draining people away from the, you know, primetime games. But I think it's pretty clear that the election is playing a part.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen. His story is called The Battle to Reach Election Binge Watchers. So how about the way some networks have shifted shows just to avoid competing with those televised debates?
Yeah, I mean, when 84 million people watched the first presidential debate, which is the most watched, I believe, in history, that's pretty big thing to compete with. And not even that, though. I think it just comes down to, you know, old-fashioned scheduling smarts, really. I mean, if you're looking at your fall TV season and you have some brand new shows that you're ready to unveil on a Monday night, and then you realize that the next week after that they're going to get preempted and have to go into, they're going to get preempted by the debate, you just have to keep them on the bench a little bit longer. So instead of premiering you know, some of the brand new Monday night shows on, you know, early in September as they normally would, the networks have to keep them waiting until later in October to give them room to premiere, you know, after that first big debate. So that's just an example of how, you know, the networks have to be nimble and shuffle things around, you know, not just because of sports, which is also big in the fall, but because of, you know, pretty big campaign-related events that are hitting primetime.
You mentioned books, too. What's happening with books?
Well, if you know, the fall is really a huge time to roll out brand new titles. You know, people are paying attention to books in a way that they aren't other times of the year. So it's you know, a time where publishers really try and take advantage of that interest in kind of brainy stuff, especially when it comes to, you know, nonfiction titles. But a lot of publishers worry that nonfiction titles that aren't related to politics or campaigning or, you know, relevant history are going to suffer and be overshadowed by all this stuff that's going on in the news. And so some of them are holding back some of those titles until, you know, later in the year or even early next year, just to kind of get out of the way of this big steamroller that's coming along. So, you know, and also think about the fact that most books are new, get released on Tuesdays. We got a big Tuesday coming up in the first week of November. So a lot of people are going to be at the polls instead of buying books that day. So Some publishers have kept release date, you know, kept their books off that release date to, you know, to get out of the way.
That's really something. Thanks, John. Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen. It's 21 minutes now before the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Glad you could be with us. Good Monday to you. Beyond the headlines now, this morning's Mike Gavin is here with a look at some of the other stories you'll be talking about this morning.
Good morning. Well, the Chicago Cubs high-profile Hollywood fans are well-documented, from Bill Murray to Eddie Vedder to John Cusack. Well-known Cleveland Indians fans are harder to find, however, but at least one A-list actor is rooting for the Tribe in the World Series, Tom Hanks. Hanks hosted Saturday Night Live this past weekend, and before signing off at 1 a.m., he yelled, "Go Tribe!" The reason? No, Hanks wasn't born in Ohio. He's from California originally. According to Cleveland.com, Cleveland's theater scene gave Hanks' acting career an early boost, and he's been a fan ever since. And he's scheduled to return to Cleveland on Friday, December 2nd for the Greater Cleveland Film Commission's fundraiser Behind the Camera. While by far the most well-known Indians fan, Hanks isn't the only one. Comedian and Price is Right host Drew Carey will be rooting for the Tribe, as will Carter Bays, co-creator of How I Met Your Mother.
That doesn't count. No, not behind the camera.
Well,
they're
stretching. They're obviously stretching just a little bit here when Drew Carey is number two on the list.
And we may be talking semantics also.
Okay.
Because while Tom Hanks may be rooting for Cleveland in this World Series,
yes,
wouldn't it be a stretch to say that he's actually a fan? Like a committed, you know, Indians follower,
yeah,
for years now.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not sure that's the case.
I don't know if I'd want to quiz him, but I've seen pictures. There's a picture.
Oh, I would
of him.
Want to quiz him.
there's a picture that looks like it's from the 80s. I saw on the story that has Hanks in an Indians jacket.
Oh,
you know, like one of those starter jackets,
oh,
you know, from the late 80s. So,
starter,
I mean, so it looks like it goes back a little ways,
okay,
for sure. I don't know if he knows everybody and all the history, but yeah.
If that's the case, look, I'll give him the nod.
I'm not going to take that away from Cleveland. Again,
all
they're sort of scraping the bottom here, so. Let's give them Tom Hanks, okay?
All right.
And, Gordon, when a large group of professional athletes who earn large salaries get together for a meal, one can guess what adjective will describe the check. The Dallas Cowboys were on their bye this weekend and weren't playing, but according to Scout.com, they were definitely out eating. The site posted a copy of the receipt from the team's annual rookie dinner on Twitter. The bill? Nearly $55,000.
Oh, jeez.
One can only hope that they left a decent tip. The good news for the rookies this time around is that they reportedly got to pretty much pay their own way. 6 years ago, the Cowboys left then-rookie Dez Bryant to foot a similar bill all by himself as retribution for his refusal to carry teammate Roy Williams' pads after practice, an incident that made national news at the time for Bryant's insubordination. There didn't seem to be such rookie hazing this time around, as this was promoted more as more of a team bonding event by Bryant and other current Cowboys veterans.
Wow.
But still, though, I think, again, there's sort of some dispute here. Some of them said, I think Brian said that he thought that the rookies pretty much just paid their own way. There was another veteran who said that the rookies split the check for everybody, right? So let's say there's 10 rookies or whatever, and they split the check for everybody. That would have been a much bigger bill.
Yeah.
It would have been like, you know, $5,000 apiece,
sure,
or something like that. You know, nothing to sneeze at for a rookie, for sure.
I vaguely remember the Dez Bryant story.
Yeah.
Like a $50,000 bill on his own.
Right, right. He had to pay for the whole thing by himself.
You might not even have the credit yet.
Yeah.
You might not even gotten some of that first payment money yet. 50 something grand if it was in that neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, you're a rookie just out of college, right? Like,
right,
you said, you might not have a credit card with any kind of limit like
Holy
that. Yeah,
smokes. Imagine that. Hey, Mom, you know that house I bought you? Yeah, we're going to have to give that
back. You have to wash an awful lot of dishes to pay for $55,000.
Thank you, Mike. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. It's 8 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning. Bruce Vail is back with more of America's First News.
Donald Trump will spend the next few days in Florida trying to garner support in one of the swing states that polls suggest remain competitive. In-person early voting begins today in the Sunshine State, and Mr. Trump says he likes his chances there.
Even the media is giving pretty good numbers. They can't help it. But the numbers are even better than what they're saying. So get out. We'll get rid of crooked Hillary once and for all, and that'll be that.
Meantime, Hillary Clinton has jumped out to a double-digit advantage in the first ABC News election tracking poll. The national survey has her leading Donald Trump by 12 percentage points among likely voters, 50% to 38%. It was a gruesome scene near Palm Springs, California, Sunday morning, where 13 people were killed and dozens more injured when a bus slammed into the back of a tractor trailer. The charter bus was returning to Los Angeles from a casino trip when it hit the rear of the truck at what police said was a high rate of speed. The Pentagon reportedly is looking to recover decade-old reenlistment bonuses paid to thousands of California Army National Guard soldiers who went to Iraq and Afghanistan. The soldiers have been ordered to repay cash bonuses they received after audits revealed overpayments by Guard officials who were under pressure to meet enlistment targets. California House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy says it's unfortunate they're required by law to try to recover that money.
They fought for our country. They've done everything that we've asked them to, and they didn't commit fraud. They just got caught up in it.
A Florida man who was pulled over for speeding last year and arrested when an officer mistook frosting from a donut for methamphetamine is now suing the city of Orlando and the maker of a roadside drug testing kit, which turned in a false positive for drugs and resulted in his arrest. The man spent 10 hours in jail and is now suing because his mugshot is now permanently on the internet.
Wow. How about a false positive in that case? What a nightmare.
A little too much glaze.
Wow. That's terrible. Man, good story, though. Thank you, Bruce. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Coming up next, why in Rhode Island there was a protest regarding yoga pants. Thanks for being with us. Hell hath no fury, apparently, like a woman scorned over her yoga pants. Hundreds of women, girls, and other supporters proudly donned their yoga pants yesterday as they peacefully paraded around the Rhode Island neighborhood of a man who said yoga pants were tacky. Alan Sorrentino had written a letter to the editor of the Barrington Times last Wednesday describing yoga pants as the worst thing in women's fashion since the miniskirt. He argued that yoga pants belong in the yoga studio and that women over the age of 20 shouldn't wear them in public. He suggested slacks instead. He said the response to his letter has been vicious and that he's received death threats. Said he was just trying to be humorous. But organizers say this wasn't a protest against Mr. Sorrentino specifically, but rather pushback against men dictating how women should dress. I'm not sure who still does that. Mr. Sorrentino says he thought the letter would be comic relief from presidential politics. Even says he owns a pair of yoga pants. Dude, they're called Under Armour, or men call them running pants. Men don't own yoga pants. That'll do it for this hour. For Bruce Vail, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.